Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of November. Joining us this hour is the senior editor of Congressional Quarterly, Jody Schneider, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of news today. We'll be looking at the heads of the big three automakers who were, as you know, before Congress on Tuesday asking for government aid. Two out of three, reports are saying, might run out of money before the end of the year. The problems, according to the heads of the big three, because they say it's a weak economy and an inability of consumers to obtain credit to buy cars, not management mistakes on the part of GM, Chrysler, and Ford. We'll talk about this, and we have a lot of potential cabinet member positions to talk about this hour as well. We'll look at how Joe Lieberman kept his position as chair of the Homeland Security Committee, why he was forgiven. And we'll talk about Janet Napolitano, Tom Daschle, Hillary Clinton, and others during the course of this hour. And welcome your phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many. A lot going on as the transition proceeds. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's okay. The number there or the address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Jody. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. A lot going on. Let's start with the big three meeting before Congress this week. What is the possibility that two out of three I've read might run out of money before the end of the year?
Yeah, it certainly looks possible. Now, it seems, you know, amazing that this could happen, but what we're talking about is that because of the credit crunch and because of the inability to tap markets to be able to borrow, as well as on the other side, that the consumer demand for automobiles, particularly American-made automobiles, has nearly dried up. I mean, dealerships are in terrible straits right now. And also dealerships are finding that they're having trouble with their credit and being able to stock their inventories. It's this kind of whole cyclical thing. And the fear, of course, is if that even one of the big three automakers was to fail, to go into bankruptcy, that would have very severe repercussions for the rest of the economy, that it would drag down the entire manufacturing sector, and it would have very severe effects on the economies of states like Michigan and Ohio, which are already suffering, but would be suffering in a new and in a way that they would not necessarily be able to, to help their citizens in even the most basic of ways. So I think there's a lot of real fear about what could happen if one of these were to fail.
Mm-hmm. And there could be a loss, I've read, as many as 3 million jobs. Is that an overstatement?
I don't think so. I don't
really
think so, because if you look at, it's not only, the automakers have already been laying off, but then you look at where that goes from there, that suppliers obviously would have to lay people off, and anybody dealing with, retail sales and those kinds of things would drop even further. So the whole service economy of some big important states would essentially go into a severe depression. So I think you could see very large unemployment numbers for certain states. And we don't know how much that is then going to translate. As we're seeing right now, the fact that people are not buying, and the retail sales numbers we've seen that have come out in the past week and the retail price numbers that have come out in the past week basically show people are just not spending money, and that is having, big effects as that reverberates through the economy.
Why is it there's not $25 billion or $50 billion of that $700 billion economic rescue fund available for the auto industry? Would it just set a bad precedent, and then everybody, not that they're not already, will be asking for some of that money themselves?
Well, I think there's a few things going on there. First of all, the White House, the Treasury Secretary and the White House made it clear that they didn't think that $700 billion financial bailout package was. They said it's for banks, and they're not going to use it for the automakers. So that was sort of a decision they made. And then Congress could have pushed on that. However, Senate Republicans did not appear to be in the mood to do that. And they really blocked their efforts to carve out that additional $25 billion for the auto industry. Democrats wanted it. I think they wanted to make sure that Barack Obama would not be taking office as the economy went into an even further tailspin because of a potential bankruptcy among one of the big three. They appeared ready, though, once to let the bailout wait rather than accept the new terms of Republicans, which really were to alter an existing auto loan program at the Department of Energy. They really want this money to be from, you know, this bigger pool. And now the Democrats are saying, well, we'll just have to wait until January until we have a new president, a Democrat in the White House.
Hmm. Judy, do you think that the big three really have to change the way the kinds of automobiles they're building? They just need to revamp and restructure and build green cars and come up with new technology and money, whatever money may be earmarked, which I imagine might be eventually, will have to be targeted for that?
Yeah, I think you know, nearly everybody, economists and people who study the auto industry and people who study innovation, and even in the testimony earlier this week of some of the automaker, you know, some of the heads of the auto companies indicated that they cannot continue to do business the way they're doing business, both in terms of a lack of innovation, a lack of a lack of looking at what the consumer wants and heading that way, and on the energy front, of course, and the environmentally friendly front. But also, they've had major problems with the way they're structured because they have historically been structured around having to give in to the labor unions. And they've had these, you know, their work rules are structured around the labor unions and their labor contracts. And they are really been dragged down by them. We have seen the, you know, automakers who do well in America are those who are owned by overseas companies that have not had the constraint of those labor contracts the way that the big three have. And I think that's going to be a very interesting issue, particularly because labor unions were such large supporters of Barack Obama and of the Democrats in this most recent election. They raised a lot of money for them. They did a lot to get out the vote. And I think they're going to have to be very careful how they then respond to them in terms of this new world order that everybody is saying is going to need to be imposed on the automakers for them to be able to be a viable industry.
They may have to lessen some of their benefits.
Well, certainly. I mean, the benefits and the retiree benefits and the health benefits are huge, and they are not the same burden that the automakers, the foreign automakers, have. Including those who are making cars in this country, who can offer lower prices and can, you know, because they are not dragged down by those huge benefit packages.
We're telling our audience, feel free to carry on with the automaker discussion. We're going to just touch on a number of different issues. There is a lot happening right now, so pick whatever part of our discussion you'd like to center on. Let's talk about Joe Lieberman for a moment. Why was he forgiven?
He was forgiven because it made sense to forgive him. It was, you know, the part of politics is just the reality of, you know, the here and now. And Joe Lieberman had been given the Democrats their effective majority in the Senate this past term, these past 2 years. Even though he's an independent, he ran as an independent after having lost his primary in Connecticut as a Democrat and pledged to the voters of Connecticut that he would caucus with the Democrats, he would vote with the Democrats. And he had. And he was an important vote. There was a lot of frustration and some anger over his, not only over his campaigning for Senator McCain and the Republicans, but particularly over the speech he made at the Republican National Committee this summer. However, you know, politics is, it's reality as well. And they realized, particularly, I think, after now President-elect Obama sort of signaled that, hey, I'm over it, his position on this had been, don't necessarily punish him. I think that gave Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and the other Democratic leaders of the Senate some latitude to say, okay, you know, we're not happy about the way you acted. Joe Lieberman made some conciliatory remarks. He got stripped of a subcommittee chair, and he lost a seat on a committee, but he keeps his chairmanship of the Homeland Security Committee, which is what he wanted.
It is amazing to me, maybe politics just haven't been played this way for a while, but isn't it amazing to you that Obama is just not being vindictive at all? I'd be a little bit upset with Joe Lieberman, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think most of these politicians, frankly, get over it more quickly than we might think. You know, they're politicians. They're professional lawmakers. That's what they do. They trade, votes. They trade It really is a back and forth kind of game, and you have to have a pretty thick skin or you're not going to last in that business.
Yeah.
However, I think publicly, when it is expedient politically to punish someone, they will. Here, I think because of the statements that Barack Obama made, and because of the fact that he had given them their effective majority this past term, and they could continue to, they'd like his vote. They want another Democratic vote these next 2 years. That it made more sense for them to do this and to sort of publicly take him to task a little bit, and then to allow him to keep his chairmanship. And the subcommittee thing seems kind of silly to me to take that away, but I guess they felt like they could at least say, well, we did something.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some names. One surfacing this morning, Janet Napolitano to be head of Homeland Security. Yesterday, Tom Daschle to be head of Health and Human Services. Do you see problems in confirmation there? What do you think of those picks?
Yeah, I think these picks were both pretty much expected. The Arizona governor is a border governor who's going to be responsible for immigration policy and border security, and so that sort of makes sense. She brings law and order experience from her stint as the Arizona's first female attorney general. She is one of the nation's most prominent female elected officials and made a lot of appearances for Barack Obama during the campaign. She had been reelected to a second four-year term in 2006. So I think she's, that one's kind of expected. She was a good soldier. He's going to need, the president-elect is going to need some women, some prominent women in his cabinet, and I don't think there's going to be much problem with the vetting process or the confirmation process for her.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Daschle, he is clearly somebody who knows how to get things done in the Senate. He was the Senate Majority Leader before losing his seat. And I think this forecast that they're going to be very serious about trying to get a health plan through the Congress by putting somebody of the knowledge and the ability to work with Congress that Tom Daschle has, they're showing that, I think, and in that particular job of Health and Human Services Secretary, I think it shows that they really are going to try to play ball on health care.
Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's still up in the air.
So, it is, isn't it?
There's a lot of talk. It seemed the minute that she was vetted and she went to Chicago and met with the president-elect, everybody was acting, there was all the, she's going to get the job. They just have to, make sure that they can pave the way for that by making sure that her husband doesn't have conflicts of interest on the international stage. However, there's people in Washington who are saying that it is not a done deal, and that Hillary Clinton herself has not necessarily decided she wants that job. So I don't know that that's as much of a done deal as it appears to be.
And then we were hearing news last night. What are you hearing today? That maybe they're going to fashion, I don't even know what it would be, some kind of new position for her in the Senate?
Yes, that could be. And I think in some ways, from all we've heard and seen, she might appreciate that and enjoy that kind of position more. She has enjoyed her term in the Senate. She has, she's made, and she's into the start of her second term. She's worked well with other senators. She's worked well across the aisle. She has a good reputation there. Secretary of State is a job that basically, you may not be able to have so many successes with. There would be an awful lot of, pressure on what she could do and on what her husband could do on the world stage. He would be limited. So I don't know that in her mind, if she could have more of a leadership position in the Senate, that might be more to her liking. She's a junior senator from New York. Chuck Schumer is the senior senator, so she's been limited. She's not a chairman of any committees or anything. If they could find some more, role for her that would allow her to have a bigger voice and to have a bigger leadership role in the Senate, I think maybe she'd take that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it brings in the decision of Secretary of State. John Kerry's been somebody who's mentioned. He clearly wants it. I don't know how much they want him to have it, and I think some of the Hillary Clinton talk maybe has been because they're not so sure about Kerry. Other names, Richard Holbrooke has been mentioned, and Governor Richardson
right.
from New Mexico, which would basically give you the first Hispanic Secretary of State and Hispanic member of the cabinet, which I think we are going to see in some fashion because I think that's, you know, Hispanics did end up going out and voting for Barack Obama, and I think they want to keep that part of the party in the fold, and I think a cabinet position would do that for them.
And I would think that, I don't know if he's thinking about paying people, not paying people off, but giving people positions who have been loyal to him, but Richardson certainly was. He was front and center in his support for Obama and went through a rather grueling telephone conversation with Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton when he didn't support her. I would think that he, of all people, and Obama seems to like him, unless it's, you know, a big act on stage, but I would think that there's something there for him, don't you think?
Well, I think perhaps. First of all, Richardson did come out for Barack Obama. He didn't do it when it would have mattered a little bit more. He didn't do it right after he left the race.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of let both sides kind of court him a bit. And then I think when it became more clear that Senator Clinton was losing ground, he, you know, at that point supported Senator Obama. And I think had he done it earlier, it would have been more meaningful. So I'm not so sure they think they owe him that much. I think really having a Hispanic as part of the cabinet is a bigger issue than having Bill Richardson.
Jody Schneider is our guest this hour, senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. We're talking about the heads of the big three automakers being before Congress asking for money on Tuesday, and that doesn't seem to be going very well. We're looking at possible cabinet appointments and talking about Joe Lieberman and Hillary Clinton, Tom Daschle, Janet Napolitano, Bill Richardson, and others, how the transition is progressing, and welcoming your phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What do you think of using a portion of that, and if so, how much $700 billion economic rescue fund to help GM, Chrysler, and Ford? Do you think they should be allowed to go bankrupt? What about the ripple effect in the if the auto industry goes bankrupt? How many jobs would be at risk here? What do we do about that? We can talk about all those appointments, possible appointments, what you think about those as well. So our phone lines, a couple are open right now. I would take one because I think they're going to be pretty busy. 800-486-8655 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second of our program today, we will be talking with a guest from the New York Times. They have just published this very huge book. I think it weighs 8 pounds because I was carrying it around yesterday and today. It's the complete front pages from 1851 to 2008 and is an extraordinary book. It's got DVDs in it, and it looks at the front pages of the New York Times for all those years. So we'll be talking about that, hour number two. Jody Schneider is here now, senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. We go to your phone calls. Tom from Mequon, hello.
Hi, Joanne, Kathleen. I hate to not agree with you on the automotive situation, and it's sad for me to hear on this radio station someone else against labor. It seems like I can hear enough of that on right-wing radio. I think most of the blame falls on the federal government for allowing the energy costs to get too high. That led to the banking crisis and to the mortgage crisis. And I think the way the laws are set up now, they're really against domestic manufacturers, and they need to change them back to what they used to be, say, back in the 60s and 70s, to promote American products. And I think if you let Ford and Chrysler and GM go down, those retirees, the health benefits and their pensions, the taxpayers are going to be paying for them. And I'd rather those companies keep paying for those costs. And lastly, the banking crisis is what's making it difficult for Ford and Chrysler and GM, and even Toyota and Honda. Their sales are down 30% and 40% also.
Jody.
Well, first of all, I wasn't trying to be anti-labor. The point I was making was that there are huge costs associated with the way the labor contracts are currently fashioned. I think, you know, no one would disagree with that, and that's part of getting the cost structure back in line or more in line and reducing it that Detroit's going to face, and the Democratic Party is going to face the issue of what kind of, you know, role they play in working with labor because labor was a huge supporter of them. So that was the point I was making. I think there's a lot of causes for the economic malaise we are now facing. Currently, you know, the housing crisis certainly was a big part of that, and there's all kinds of problems. We're seeing recessions in many different segments, and we're seeing a global recession as well. It's not an easy problem to solve, and they're going to be having to solve it on a lot of fronts, and a lot of different industries are going to have to be looking at how they resolve some of the problems that are inherent in their own industries.
Well, they're also in a huge pickle, don't you think, Jody, because they kept giving the American public these cars. Gas prices are low today. 6 months from now, they may be over $3. Keep giving Americans these SUV, gas-guzzling cars. They didn't seem to have much of a vision. So you can look at management of these companies and say, wait a second, it's your lack of vision. People are buying cars that were more fuel efficient, that seemed to be better made. And those were Toyota and Honda, and they've become the best-selling cars in America.
Right. I think, you know, cost is certainly a factor. But another factor is what the public wants,
right.
and marketing, the way the dealerships are run, the dealership system. The American automakers have many more dealerships than the foreign automakers, and that's another cost factor. So there's a lot of things, I think, that we're going to be looking at there that they're going to need to be looking at. The automakers themselves say, if we get this infusion, this gets us through this, you know, this very severe period and this downturn. And, you know, we want to come back. We want to do things differently, but we need to get through this. That's the pitch that they're making. It's the pitch they made on the Hill this week, and that's their goal, they say, is to try to do things in a different way. But they are hamstrung by some costs that their competitors, their foreign competitors,
mm-hmm.
don't have.
Yeah. What a mess everything is.
Not a lot of good news today.
I know,
I'm
Jody.
Sorry.
I know. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Brian from Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, Brian. How are you?
Great.
Good.
I just have a quick question for you guys about the big three, of course. And one of the major things that our host touched on was the fact that the labor unions have been, I guess, really flexing their muscles for all these years to force the auto industry to agree with their terms. Well, is it one of the options, well, if that the cash infusion isn't there, that they could actually shut down, I hate to say this, and open back up as non-union and compete on the same global scale that the Japanese automakers are doing?
Well, I don't think it's all that easy. I mean, you're not going to be able to just say to the unions, we're shutting down, we're going to abrogate your contracts, and we're going to come back as non-union. I mean, that's, you know, while that might seem to be an easy fix, it's simplistic. If they do file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, they would have to rewrite their contracts, but there's a lot of people who are thinking that particularly if GM were to go into Chapter 11 reorganization, they may not have enough cash to make it out. Therefore, it would effectively be a Chapter 7 liquidation. And that's a lot of the fear right now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Pat from Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The problem I have, everybody's talking about down the unions, no matter whether it's the UAW or any union in this country. But nobody talks about the CEOs making $20, $12, $3, $5, $6 million a year with just huge bonuses,
mm-hmm.
plus the waste that they have. And we're just middle-class people trying to make a living, trying to pay our way, trying to have insurance. Right away, they come after us for insurance. You got to take cuts in insurance. But in the meantime, they're getting a $20 million bonus or a $20 million salary. I'll take my
okay
off the air.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Hello.
Yes, Jody, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I think actually that people are starting to pay attention to that, and I think there's a lot of frustration that, you know, a lot of the kind of headlines on TV today were about the three automakers having acknowledged that they all came on private
right,
jets.
Right, right. Three
Washington.
Private jets.
They're on private jets. One of the panel members questioning them said, well, couldn't you have, like, all, you know, jet pooled or something, you know?
Oh,
or downgraded to first class? And I think there is a lot of frustration. I mean, during the bailout talk in October with the financial bailout, there was a lot of, you know, the first time that vote failed was partly because so many constituents flooded the offices of their lawmakers with emails and calls basically saying, you know, we don't want to help out these fat cats on Wall Street. You know, they got themselves into this. And only when the message came across that, well, it's not necessarily helping them out, if we don't, you know, help these companies out, the whole economy could fail, that they then went and voted for it. And I think the same thing is happening with the automakers now. There's a lot of people out there who are, you know, hurting, who are losing their jobs, who are worried about losing their jobs. Every day, you know, that's what we're calling the scariest hour of the day, the last hour of the stock market, we're all watching to see what kind of hit it might take and what kind of hit our investments might take. That people are very frustrated and they're hurting, and then they look at people who, you know, can't even, you know, go to Washington first class. They have to fly in their private jets, and saying, do we want to give more money to these people? And I think there's a legitimate frustration out there among the public and a worry that where would that money go?
Mm-hmm. You know, you got to wonder what they're thinking. What kind? Here they are asking for money from Congress, and you think somebody at coffee the morning before would have said, maybe we should all go together at least,
right, or something.
Or
get on Northwest Airlines, which does fly from Detroit to Washington, D.C.
There you go. Why not? Yeah. Okay, let's go to Mary from Burlington. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Actually, my comment is very similar to the one that you had before. And the thought, is that there's two thoughts, and it deals again with the auto workers, but could be applied to any of the companies that are coming for bailout money. Two things. First of all, have as part of the plan to get the money, have the companies be required to contract with a management consulting firm that would go in and would rationalize the management of the company so that, you know, take a look to see if it's top-heavy. You know, are there too many vice presidents? Are there too many managers? You know, what's the ratio of management to industrial worker? And the second thing is, and take a leaf from the book of the Japanese a few years back when their economy was in trouble. And what those CEOs did, what those managers did, is they gave back. They took cuts in their own salary. They got rid of their fringes before they went to labor and said, now we're asking you to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, just a combination of the two, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think there were questions like that in the panel yesterday, too. Would these the heads of these companies be willing to take pay cuts? One had already taken his salary way down. The other two really didn't answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as you said earlier, you think they would have thought that kind of question was coming and had prepared some response, but they didn't. I think in terms of requiring the companies to do certain things if they're given the bailout money, it's a real difficult situation. You don't want Congress running companies, and you don't want Congress running industries or the White House. You can't, you know, then you have socialized industries. You have government-run industries if they're saying, okay, you have to do X, Y, and Z in terms of running it. But I think there can be, and I think that this is what we will see when they come back in January for a particular industry to get money, they will have to agree to certain things, such as rules on executive compensation, such as rules about innovation in terms of making more energy-efficient vehicles, those kinds of things. But those tend to be overall things that can be measured in terms of the actual day-to-day running of the companies. I don't think, you know, it would make sense, given the fact that we have a capitalist economy, for us to start telling companies how to run their businesses.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, Jody, all the factors that will be at play come new administration time, as to how we're going to be fashioning whatever relationship the government has with the auto industry in this country. Is it the Treasury Secretary? Is it the President? How important will the makeup of a new Congress be, and whether or not there is a 60-vote filibuster-proof Democratic Senate? What factors are at play as to where we go from here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a number of things. First of all, it is, if the auto industry is going to be given a, you know, pool of money the way the Treasury has set up for it, and now, you know, now it's clear it's for the banking industry. Before, it was to buy these troubled assets. Now Secretary Paulson has said, no, we're actually investing in banks and financial institutions and trying to, you know, control the downturn that way. So if they do kind of set aside a pool of money, they certainly could put strings attached, and one would expect that they would. For instance, Republicans had wanted the industry to tap for operating costs this $25 billion Energy Department loan program, this legislation that was passed this fall, or last year, I'm sorry, to help automakers retool and shift to production of more fuel-efficient vehicles. In terms of, you know, there's very clear strings there saying this is, you know, to spend this money, you have to do X. And one would expect that would, some of that would happen with a plan if they were to pass something like that in January. The White House obviously will have a say in this, but Congress in the end will be passing the legislation, and the Democratic makeup of the Congress, the more seats that they've won in the House and then the Senate will certainly help the Democrats do that. They're probably not going to get to 60 votes. They picked up the seat. Ted Stevens has now effectively conceded in Alaska, so the Democrats are at 58 now. They would have to win in both the recount in Minnesota, which is, 50-50 at this point. Nobody really knows where that's going to go, and in the Saxby Chambliss' seat in Georgia, where they're going to have to actually have another election coming up pretty soon here, and the Democrats are not expected to win there unless there's a big upset.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll probably end up with 58 in the Senate.
Right. Let's go to Cliff is next from Appleton. Hi, Cliff.
Hi. My comment is that, you see all these $700 billion bailout and now the automobile companies. But yet, I guess I'm one of those frustrated people out there that say, well, what about us? What about the average American? I mean, you look at what happened with AIG, and they came for $89 billion and then another $25 and another, and then they're out in spas. And yet this morning, the Bush administration is going to veto an extension of unemployment benefits for average people who are going to run out of money. And what about them? And what about the, what about the saving people's houses? And I guess that's the frustration with me, that they can come and get billions of dollars and fly around in private jets, and yet the rest of us are sitting here going, what about us? And that's my comment, and I'll listen offline.
All right. Thanks very much, Cliff.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of frustration out there, and I do think that's something that the Congress and the new administration is going to have to factor in. We passed the $700 billion, the Congress passed the $700 billion rescue package in October. A month and a half later, it's not being used for the thing that they had thought it would be used for. In a lot of ways, perhaps it's being used creatively, and we have not seen huge bank failures that had been, very much predicted and worried about only a month and a half ago. And it does seem that some of that money is starting to work its way through the economy, but it's going to take a while. But because of that, I think people are frustrated and are saying, well, there's $700 billion that we're already giving, to one part of the economy. How many hands out are we going to see, and how many can we, continue to how many more of these industries can we continue to feed, even as more and more people lose their jobs?
Right.
So I think there is going to be that frustration. There's going to be that split, if you will, between Wall Street and Main Street for a while here, as Main Street really suffers, and it's going to suffer badly through the holiday season. I think we're going to see some of the worst retail sales at the holiday season that we have seen probably in 30 or 40 years.
Oh, my. And then we've got all this money that is – tell me what you know about this – that is supposedly going to rebuild the infrastructure in America, $300 billion more dollars for roads, bridges, stimulate the economy, get people back to work, et cetera. Can we do that? Do we have money to do that? Do we need to do that? Is that what we're going to do?
Well, yeah, there's two parts of the question. The first, in terms of another stimulus package, President-elect Obama has said that's the first thing he wants to do, and apparently has already started, drawing plans to do so, and members of Congress are starting to think about how they will put together legislation so that they can introduce this right away in January. It's not expected to be in the form of bailout checks, but more in a kind of almost a WPA program from the earlier, last century, from President Roosevelt's tenure, where we rebuild America, roads and bridges and other kinds of programs that would bring infrastructure and jobs. There also is talk about extending unemployment benefits, extending food stamps, those kinds of things, heating oil for low-income individuals, things like that included in that. So both to kind of help people and to get the economy going again. The second part is it's a huge price tag, obviously, and you start adding these things up. You know, $700 billion here, $300 billion there starts to be real money.
Sure.
And where's it coming from? Well, it's coming from the taxpayers, and we are seriously expanding the deficit, which had been expanded greatly under President Bush's tenure, primarily for the wars. But, you know, one starts to question at what point are we going to start talking about the cost of this. So far, nobody, save a few moderate Democrats in what we call the Blue Dog Caucus in the House, have really complained much about what this is doing to deficit spending. But I think that's something that you are going to start seeing people talk more about next term when these numbers just start to become, you know, dumbfounding.
Right. Let's go to Phil next from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. Excellent show, as always. I have a quick question. I just finished the Wall Street Journal, and page 3 has a source who I didn't write down, but they said GM is making no preparations whatever for bankruptcy, and the source is quoted as saying the reason they're doing it is they feel they're in a Lehman Brothers situation, and they can more or less bully the government into doing what they want. I want to know if you know anything about that, and I want to know what you think of that.
Well, you know, there's the whole too-big-to-fail argument, and that's one that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had been making for years, and it turned out to be correct in their case that there had been fears that if you know something happened and at the years ago when this discussion started on the Hill and in Washington about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, nobody thought that there would ever be a situation in which they could potentially fail and the government would have to take them over, but it was always sort of factored in that the government would do that because the failure of those companies, quasi-governmental companies in their case, would produce such shocks in the economy because of the large volume of mortgages that you know they were involved with. And the automakers, there's some thought on the part of some economists that the automakers are in the same kind of situation, that because of, as we discussed earlier in the program, because of the huge cyclical effects that a bankruptcy or a failure of even one of the automakers would have on the whole manufacturing part of the economy and on the economies of whole regions of the country, that the government would have to step in and do something. And I think that is part of the thinking. There may be a little bit of a game of chicken going on, particularly with the Republicans, who are saying, well, you know what, that's not necessarily the case, and we have to, if we're going to bail them out, we at least have to figure out a way to do so that makes sense.
Hmm. Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Yeah, sure, Phil.
What do you think of the theory that the government, or the Congress anyway, is going to let one of them at least get close to put the fear of God into them? Because they let Lehman's go, and I know they thought that was a mistake, but what do you think that they think they can knock the arrogance back a little and make them give a little more if one of them gets a little closer to the edge?
I don't think that's what's going on in Congress. I think that the Democrats, had they been able to get enough Republican votes, really would have liked to have done this week. And there was even a little bit of talk of coming back in December when they are coming back to do some reorganization tasks to try to do this again. Problem is that the Republicans are standing firm on not wanting to do it as a bailout, not wanting to use the Treasury money that way. And the White House is standing firm on that. There's not a whole lot for this current president, President Bush, there's not a whole lot of incentive for him to give. So I think that's the situation that they're faced with. I don't think the Democrats are wanting to sort of send a signal or teach them a lesson here. I think they would like to give them the money. They just haven't been able to deal with the political realities of how to do that at this current time.
Jody Schneider, our guest, senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. We are talking about a number of issues, mostly because of where you want to go with this. It's on whether or not we bail out the car industry in this country. We are also looking at the possibility of certain cabinet appointments being made and what you think about the names that are floated around and some confirmed, and the transition period and all of that. Our number is 800-486-8655, and you can send an email at talk@wpr.org. Thanks for your call, Phil. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Following the news from National Public Radio, the second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about this new book that has just been published. It is huge. It chronicles 157 years of history as recorded by the New York Times. It's the front pages, the complete front pages of the New York Times with 300 pages highlighting events since 1851. And then there are DVDs in here that cover all of the front pages from all of those years. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. Back to phone calls for Jody Schneider, senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. And let's go to Michael next from Wauwatosa. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, ladies.
Hello.
I heard Ms. Schneider sort of touch on this earlier, and I'm not quite sure where she stands on it. But I've heard this argument in numerous times that the American car companies have just been giving American consumers the products that they want as far as SUVs. And I think that's kind of short-sighted. I mean, obviously, Toyota and Honda appeased American car buyers as well. And also, obviously, American car buyers can change their mind in a minute. And they can go from SUVs to now I want a hybrid. So I'm wondering what her opinion is on that and how legitimate an argument that is for the excuse for the American car buyer or the American car manufacturers. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
Well, I think there's a lot of, you know, this is a very complicated situation that the automakers have gotten themselves into, and there's not going to be any easy fixes. But some of the things are in terms of the way that they have operated, for instance, their dealerships, that they have many, many, many more dealerships than their foreign counterparts in the country. And is that a good way to sell your product? Is that the way people are buying cars now? The other thing is having many more styles of automobiles than their foreign competitors do. That's a costly way to run a business, and there's been some thinking that if they limited the choices, that they might do better. I think there's a whole lot, you know, and the business has been run in a way that has not, frankly, changed very much over the decades. And while others have come in with very different, not only labor practices, but business and management practices, and there's a lot of talk about that having to change as well. On the issue of giving consumers what they want versus what would be better for them, it is tricky. And as you know, consumers were happy to buy the SUVs, and now they can't get rid of them and are, you know, don't want to go back that way, and that's part of still what Detroit is selling. The auto industry can't turn on a dime, but the fact is that that economists are saying and people who study the industry are saying that a lot more needs to be done in terms of looking down the road at not only what kinds of cars they're selling, but also the rest of their business practices and making them much more competitive.
We go next to Bill from Ortonville. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you? This is a great show. My main topic was covered a little bit earlier, but I'm very much concerned about the average folks out there. Everybody's talking about bailouts for executives and flying jets and bonuses and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I live out near Janesville, and that plant closing out here is going to affect thousands of people,
Right.
of people.
Right.
I don't hear, the lady there talked a little bit about Obama's package coming, but these folks are going to need help or there's going to be unrest in the streets.
What kind of help do you want them to have?
Well,
Bill, what are your ideas?
They need to have stability in their job situation, and if mm-hmm. that keeps the automobile companies going while that they go through these reorganizations, if the money goes for something like that to keep the family stability going, I would be for that. I mean, you don't have to let them tear them down and sell them off somewhere else. I mean, this business here is just not going well. Well, we see the people with jobs commentating on radio and everything like that. They're going to have to lose their jobs. But these folks out here are losing jobs. And you know, we don't hear from them. You know, it's just not right.
Well, I think that the core of the concern right now about doing something quickly is the fact that we're going to see, that we would see more job cuts. I don't think that's being ignored. I mean, I think that's being used as sort of the push to get Congress to do something. And even in the statements of the automakers, that was the point they were making, that it would be catastrophic for one of their companies to go out of business because of the huge amount of jobs that would be lost and the damage that would do to communities and individuals.
Sure.
So I don't think anyone's really ignoring that. What they could do to help them in the short run, I think, is an interesting question. And one of the things we haven't talked about is states are hugely burdened by what is happening and by job losses because they have to pay, you know, they pay unemployment mm-hmm. insurance. They have to deal with, you know, if there's, you know, they have more people on their Medicaid rolls, those kinds of things, and they're not getting, you know, those things are often not covered by the federal government. The states at a time when they are, their budgets are really under pressure and having to do all kinds of cuts are also having to provide more services as people are in trouble. So I think that's a, that is a real issue that, you know, Washington is going to have to look at as well. What do they do to help the states, particularly states that are really hard hit, like Michigan and Ohio?
And thank you very much, Bill, for your call. Yeah, you make an excellent point. Let's go next to, where are we? Roger is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Roger.
Good morning, ladies. A couple questions. First, obviously it's appalling they fly in on their jets and all these other things. But if they want $25 billion and they've already been given $25 billion, is it a fair assessment to say that if you were to take the top two or three echelons of these executives in the auto industry and even the union leaders, that if you cut their salary by 25%, you'd probably find $1 billion right there? And then secondly, and really more important, I was somewhat appalled. I have several inventions and patents and things, and I'm not asking for any kind of the money these guys are asking for. But I can't go to a table with potential investors or people who have invested in an idea and come back and ask for money without coming with a plan. And these guys yesterday actually had to be asked to come up with, you know, show us a plan. I would have thought they would have already had that and brought it with them so that they could get this thing rolling if they really wanted to. So I was a little appalled at the way they handle themselves in that regard. And, you know, I'll take my comment off the air, but it just shocks me. And lastly, the last person on, what about the common guy? I have no mortgage. I live within my means completely, and here I'm giving money to bail out everybody. And I find that I should be exempt from having to give any money to any bailout because I've lived easily within my means, and I don't make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Really, I'll take my comments.
Thanks, Roger.
Off the air, and I hope everybody has great holidays.
Thanks. Thanks. You too, Roger. Jody.
Well, I'm going to respond to the last part of that question, and I think, you know, that there is a lot of, and we saw a lot of this in October when we were talking about, you know, the money for the financial institutions, and people were saying, look it, you know, and we hear about this too when people are talking about should we set up programs to help people who are having trouble with their mortgages, who bought too much house or can't afford their mortgages now. And there's a lot of people who are very frustrated by this who are saying, look it, I played by the rules. You know, I paid my mortgage on time. I didn't buy too much house. Some people said I didn't buy a house because I didn't think I could really afford it over time. And, you know, that I've been living within my means. I've been working two jobs, you know, all those kinds of things.
Sure.
And I'm hurting because, you know, the economy's hurting, but nobody's going to bail me out. And, you know, what about the old rules of capitalism? You work hard, you invest, you get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's another real source of frustration right now among people. And I do think that that is something that the Congress and the new administration is going to have to be very careful about in whatever kinds of plans they craft, both to help people who are hurting, you know, people who are not even, you know, working at this point, the unemployed and others, but also to help out people who may be viewed as somewhat victims of this, but made some decisions that helped, you know, that led to the problems, including the automakers and including some of the homeowners. And so I do think that there's a real, you know, this is a kind of water cooler talk you hear and coffee roundtable chatter, but I think it's true, and I think it is also something that there really needs to be incentives for people who who are going to be seeking money. What is it that you're going to do in return?
Well,
and I
course.
Also agree with his point that their performance did seem to be lacking yesterday, not only about the planes and about the compensation, but about when asked, what's your plan, they were very vague on that.
One more phone call. We have 1 minute left. Leslie from Preston, Minnesota. Hi.
Oh, boy. I don't know if I can do it in a minute.
Try.
It's just so frustrating that where's the common sense? Way back when the automakers decided to go the route of the SUVs rather than the fuel efficient, they got a whole bunch of people with bright ideas canned over that deal. Then now they're just, who couldn't see that writing on the wall? It's so frustrating to be Joe Public and see all these decisions made that are so stupid. When you see stores go up one after the other after the other, who can support all those stores? I mean, someday we got to bite the bullet. And to keep bailing people out is only postponing the pain. We have to do the pain. I can see spending $1 billion for soup kitchens in communities for a while until we get our ducks in a row. There's so many ways that we can use money efficiently to help in an emergency type situation rather than keep making money and getting in a hole.
Thanks, Leslie, for your call. Well, there's a lot of concern out there and a bit of anger. Jody, thank you so much for being with us. You're a wonderful guest. Enjoyed the hour.
Thank you very much.
Jody Schneider is senior editor of Congressional Quarterly. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee and for all of your calls and thoughts. We appreciate them. News is coming up from National Public Radio in just a moment. We'll return with another hour of Thursday conversation, so stay with us. It's a minute now before 10 o'clock on this Thursday morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.